Okay, so tonight we're going to do the second part on the JDBC, the Java Database Connection. And last time we did the two-tier example that showed the code for a Java Database Connection and directly went to a just for a particular database on Oracle and Osprey 7. So this time we're going to start with another example. There's more on database architecture later in this lecture, but let me just explain it some now. But the two-tier example was called that way because the Java classes that implemented the JDBC application interface, the so-called API, had proprietary code that went directly to the Oracle database. That's one of the WebLogic Oracle database drivers that we have licensed to run on Osprey 7. And so that example, which I think I showed in enough detail that you can all program yourselves because you have accounts on Oracle database on Osprey 7, though you have to actually run the Java applet with Netscape running on Osprey 7. But WebLogic has other drivers which can run other places which don't have that constraint, so I'll show that in a little bit. But this example coming up is a so-called three-tier example, and it gets around the limitations that the two-tier example had by having a server in the middle. I'm calling it a server in the general sense. I should say a program. It's a middleware program. And so the classes that implement JDBC can run anywhere on the web because they are to use some sort of standard internet or network protocol to talk to a middleware program, which will then use proprietary information to get directly to the database product itself. So this is a three-tier example. The software that's in the middle is called the middle tier, and it's in between the client, which you might think of as being the sending queries from an applet on the network browser, goes to the middle tier first, and then it transmits the actual SQL query to the database. So the main reason, one of the reasons this is a good thing, is that you don't have to install or download vendor-specific classes on your browser. So that if you're a user on a Netscape browser with the three-tier thing, the Java classes that get downloaded are generic and they would run on any browser. Whereas in a two-tier system, you would have to download something that was specific to a particular, I mean, they would depend on which machine your browser was running on, right? You would have to download a different JDBC for if you were running on a PC than if you were running on a Sun, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The other thing that can happen is that when you use a network protocol between the browser and the middleware, is that the network protocol can, in fact, be optimized for best performance over that kind of a network, whereas the kind of connections that you get between the middleware and the database product aren't necessarily optimized for performance over those kinds of long-range networks. The example we're going to look at is uses the Java servlets, but there are other examples. Two of them are listed here, WebLogic's T3 server, Bulletproof's JAG server. And I think on the page that I gave you there was a list of links to some of these other products. So let's look at the Java servlet solution. So the Java servlet is a web server written in Java. and this web server can know about essentially they're like little Java applications that can run on the server side. And these are called servlets, so that the client, the web browser, can connect to a server and ask to run a particular server-side code. So this is the same kind of thing you had with the CGI mechanism, except that you were when we did the CGI mechanism, you could run Perl programs or something like that, right? So this enables you to connect to the server and run Java as essentially a CGI-type program. And those are the servlets. So you can consider these as the server-side counterpart to applets because they will be compiled just like applets are to bytecodes. They are loaded on demand, so they're not part of the server itself. But they are different from applets in that they're not providing the window interface the way the applets that you write to serve on the browser, of course, have the property that they always have to be controlling the browser window. And these are not like that. They're more like applications, more like standalone programs. So one of the ways that you can invoke a servlet is by giving a particular URL. So if you have a Java server installed, it can have on a particular host and port, it will have one of its directories, document directories, be the servlet directory. And you just specify which servlet you want to call, and this URL will, the Java web server will run it for you. So we're going to talk just a little bit about writing Java servlets. I didn't produce like a tutorial on how to write them because I didn't think it was very practical to either everybody had to put up their own Java web server on their own port, or we had to work out a scheme for you all to write servlets and register it with a server that we would give you in common. And it looked pretty tricky for to accomplish just in this last week or two. But I'll just give you some hints, some of the scheme here. So there is a class called java.servlet, or it's a package, and you either make yourself be a subclass of something called a generic servlet or an HTTP servlet. So an HTTP servlet is the class that you would use if you were wanting to communicate with an applet on the browser, or on Netscape or something. And so that's the kind of thing that we're wanting to do in this example. So here's an example of writing the Hello World servlet. So you import java.io, you import java.servlet, and you start a class which extends, in this case, generic servlet, because it doesn't have to do any HTTP. And the main thing that you have to do is override this particular method called service. You have to provide a service method. The servlet class, both servlet classes assume that you're going to provide this method, and it's sort of akin to in applets to the paint method. It's always there as something that's going to show, going to run the right thing. So the service method has two arguments. It has something of type servlet request, which is where you expect to get parameters and information from whatever program is running this. In addition, there is an argument, there should be a space in there. RES is supposed to be of type servlet response, and this is argument is for you to provide, or this service method to provide the response. So in this particular case, it turns out that RES, one of the methods it has is get output stream. We made it into a print stream, and then we can just print hello world, and that puts hello world on the output stream to the response. So it ignores the request and just prints out hello world. there are other methods that you can override for to give us interesting information. One of them is get servlet info, and in this case we're just returning what is the name of this particular servlet. But you can imagine that there might be, that for some applications there might be other interesting things that you would want to give. So the other example that we have is one that shows how to use servlets to access Oracle database. So it uses WebLogic's JDBC driver to connect to the Oracle database on Osprey 7, which is what we were doing in the two-tier example, but now we're going to have a servlet that's in between as the middle tier. So this servlet is a general purpose one. It connects to any user database that you type in the name and password. It allows you to run queries on that database and displays the query results, and it gives information about the driver. So here are snippets of the code, and I can show you the complete code as well. It's on the web page so that you can look at it in more detail. But here are snippets. It's a class called dbServlet. This particular one is extending HTTP servlet. And here is the service method that you have to extend. It has the same two arguments as the other generic servlet did, a request, which is, in this case, HTTP servlet request, and a response, HTTP servlet response. Now, the request has various methods, and one of the important ones is get parameter, which we can use to similar way that Java applets can say get parameter to get information from the HTML form. So these parameters are things that are passed by the client that's connecting to this server. So you can, all right, so there's username, password, query. We create an output stream as before. Now we're going to actually connect to the same WebLogic Oracle server. Well, first we create the URL. Then we have to do this standard forName method, which loads the classes for the driver. So this is the WebLogic driver. Then we use the method getConnection on the driver manager to actually connect to a particular database and password. Then we do the standard thing about creating a statement. You execute that statement by doing execute query, and you get back a result set, and then you can call some function which displays the results. And display result set would look something like that. Okay. So, on this browser, I have loaded up the page that I told you about last time. I know not everyone was here last time, so let me write down that URL again. Somewhere I brought a marker, but it's underneath all the microphone power thingies. Here we go. Osprey 7, and if you're local, you don't have to put npack, etc., but if you're not local, you know how to do that, right? And then the port number is 8110, and the web page is cps616.html. So Tom Pulikow is one of the graduate students who helped prepare this, installed this web page. So there are some links, as I showed you last time, to some of the documentation about JDBC if you want to check out the JDBC API and so on. Actually, come to think of it, I think on this web, I'm not sure the API is there. I think there's a download form. Let me talk to Tom and have him put up, I mean, we have that downloaded, so we have a local link to the actual JDBC API, or either that or it's part of the JDK 1.1. So I'll have him put on a link so that you can look at the entire API. Somebody remind me to do that. And then there's information about Java Web Server, formerly called Jeeves, and all about the servlet mechanism. And then these WebLogic and Intersolve are both providers of JDBC drivers. So this is example, the three-tier example that I just looked at is listed here, and you can look at some of the source code. Okay. Whoops. Ah, shoot. For a minute there, I thought I pushed the wrong auxiliary. For a minute there, I thought I'd lost both projectors. Oh, also on Tom's page, down at the bottom, he describes how to use this particular application. It's called DB Diagram, and he's downloaded it and put it in his directory. And at the bottom of that web page, he explains how to run it. There's a README file that you can use to see how to run it. Okay, and it's just a tool for looking at databases. If you have a bunch of databases installed, this Java application, you give it your username and your password. Do you remember how if you have more than one database, you can structure it into a, I've forgotten the word for a bunch of databases? Not a package, I'm thinking Java. But equivalent to that, putting a bunch of databases together, and then if you have them structured even more, then you might have them registered in a schema. But you can just ignore all that. Give us the schema, your own user ID, ignore. Anyway, and so whatever databases you have, this puts up a little diagram that shows for each database what the connections are between the various ones, how they use each other, what the primary keys, well, how they use each other in terms of relations between the various databases, and also about the primary and foreign keys. Okay, now I'm going to kind of switch gears a little bit. And so far in this course, we've talked a lot about the relational database Oracle. And we're also, a lot of these solutions are being used with the database Microsoft Access. There's lots of other databases that are MSQL that are being used, but this is another particularly big one, and it's kind of a change of pace because this is what runs on PCs. So Access is a desktop relational database, and it runs under Microsoft Windows of various sorts. And it's part of, for example, Office 97 that we're having, that we have installed in the new PC lab, and we're getting some of these drivers installed there too, so that you can do database web connections, JDBC to connect to Access. Now, in some ways, Access is similar to Oracle in that there is a whole interactive system that you might think of as being similar to Oracle SQL Plus system, where you just interactively put in commands that interact with the database. Then, in addition, there is a library. You can make a whole programming interface, of which in Oracle there are several different programming interfaces that we talked about, PLSQL, WOW, the various ways to use CGI. And Access has those as well. It has usually Visual Basic languages like Visual C++ to write programs to access the database. On the other hand, the interactive system is much different from the Oracle system in that it's a whole desktop database system that's very Windows pull-down menu point-and-click oriented. So in Oracle, the interactive part was just this line thing, right? And Access has this whole windowing system. So sort of traditionally, databases like Oracle had more features and more functionality than desktop relational databases, but Access is on the high end of those as far as functionality is concerned and has quite a lot of features, including programmable features, and they're getting more and more because they're really getting into the programmable side of it and not just the desktop use. So if you were using an Access database, you would probably say, yes, it's more user-friendly. There's an editing interface that allows you to create tables and data more easily. The other thing is that the new version, Access 97, can integrate data from the other kinds of products like spreadsheets. That's the whole sort of Office 97 concept, is that all these different applications can talk to each other and communicate and have different kinds of data passed. In Access, when you want to have a sort of a user-friendly way for people to put in data to the database, you design things which are called forms, in which different types of people can input different fields. You're probably familiar with this kind of thing. This can actually be fairly complex depending on what your system is. In addition, there are things called reports to output various kinds of data. And Access is working on making this not only interactive but programmable as well. For example, to export forms directly to the web interface that were defined in the interactive system. So that's kind of nice. So I haven't been using Access much, but I've been using ActiveX because that's what the next lecture is going to be on Wednesday. And how many of you normally use a PC and use these kind of Office products? A few. Okay. So I think it's typical of these kind of products that when you're going to do some programming parts, they have what they call a wizard, right? At least in ActiveX, that's what it is. When you want to write the little scripts that respond to events, you have the wizard that helps you write them. And so Access also has all sorts of wizards. There's the form and report wizards that help you create forms and create reports. But in addition, it has some higher level things. It has a table analyzer wizard, and it looks at this. If you give it flat file data and define a bunch of flat files, it'll try to look at it and analyze and help you make that into a relational database. I haven't used it, but that's the report. I don't know how successful that is. There's a simple query wizard where you have a very simple language to look for queries. I think this is what's called query by example. Is that right? The database wizard helps you then go ahead and set up those database applications. Whoops, I didn't mean to scroll that. Performer analyzer wizard, after you set up the database, looks at the structure. There's all sorts of things where you can have performance. If you have a fairly complex relational database, you have to be thinking about which columns have keys defined on them, which ones have unique values, and what the relations are between the different ones. There's all sorts of ways in which performance is an issue in interacting with how you've designed the database. And this helps you with that. the Ole automaton, is it automation, excuse me. Is it okay to call this Ole? Everybody does, don't they? And not OLE? Where are you PC people? Yes. Is the part that helps, we'll go into more detail about this later, that helps share information between the various applications like Access and ActiveX. So it does have support for ActiveX controls. Maybe I should just say a word about what ActiveX controls are. I'm going to talk about that next time, and people usually talk about ActiveX as, in many ways, it's a rival to JavaScript and Java, or Java, in that you can write things that help you deal with forms, input data, buttons, layout, all sorts of interactive elements of the browser. So ActiveX is what you use to, you know, do browser programming, the same way you would JavaScript or Java. But ActiveX is extended from Ole. It has the same kind of what they call controls that many other of the Microsoft applications do. So what is a control? A control can be something simple like a button or a text box, and in that sense you can think of a control as kind of being like an object in an object-oriented point of view. And in fact, the script language that you use with ActiveX is object-oriented and treats all those things as objects. But a control can also be more complicated than that. A control can be an entire program that somebody would download to run from their, in this, either from Access or from ActiveX to do some entire application. So a control can be very complicated. All right, so people use the word control to mean a wide range of things, wide range of functionality. But it's a way for the Microsoft products to organize sort of the interface between all these applications is by making everything into a control and taking an object-oriented point of view. So here's a little bit more about that. So in the Access model, it's going to interface with this object-oriented model, so it does take an object point of view of all the database elements. So everything that you can do, tables, queries, forms that you make, fields, are represented as objects in the Access model. So if you are going to make an Access application, you create objects which represent these various kinds of data, and then you can respond to events that the user does. And so it's the usual sort of event handling programming that we saw both in Java and in JavaScript, right? So if the user clicks on a button, that's an event, and you can provide a little program that does a response to that. So in Access event handlers, there are essentially macro ones from sort of the, and I'm not sure what the language is for the macros. I think that's just an older script language, but I'm not sure. I'd have to check on that. I'm not an Access expert. But anyway, and various kinds of module functions, event procedures, things that respond to particular forms. So for these, for the more general functions and procedures, the language that you use to write these event handlers is Visual Basic for applications, VBA. And Visual Basic, how many of you have ever written any basic programs? Or how many of you have ever seen a basic program? I've seen a basic program. I've never actually written a basic program. Okay. So Visual Basic is extended from that. So it's, I mean, in this course so far, practically everything we've seen has been very C-oriented. But Visual Basic is more, how shall I put it, basic. It's more like Fortran in kind of the syntax, the way it is. But it's not hard, and you can easily program from the examples that you see. And it's also object-oriented. So Visual Basic has objects. You can define classes, and it's a full-blown object-oriented language. When we do ActiveX, the language that you use for writing the scripts is Visual Basic Script, which is a subset of the full-blown Visual Basic object-oriented language. Okay, I've kind of already said Visual Basic is object-oriented, and modules, so the classes are called class modules. They have two events. When you create the class, it's called the initializer. When the class goes away, it's the terminator. And now I have some slides in here, just sort of completeness for the access set about relational databases. And I don't think we need to go over those in detail here because you've already done a lot about relational databases with Oracle, right? So you already know about the relational database model. So you maybe I should just remind you of some of the terminology. A primary key is a column or a set of columns that has unique value. So, for example, that's a good thing to look up. It's a good thing to index a table by. It's a good thing to look up information by. It has unique value. A foreign key is a column in one table that references a primary key in another. You can have various relationships among the columns of the table. And for among the tables. And so for these relationships are characterized as one-to-one, one-to-many, and many-to-many, depending on how many rows of one table are related to rows of another table. And there are two integrity rules about information. I won't go over those again. And I also won't go into a lot of detail about the SQL. I have some slides here about SQL. So in Access, it also has the query by example, QBE, type query language, but they have mapped that both ways into the to standardize it into SQL, so that everybody's agreed on essentially SQL as the standard for a database interface. Access's SQL is based on SQL 89 and some parts of SQL 92. And I believe, so that's similar to what Oracle had. I think Oracle has all of SQL 92 as the interface language. So in Access, you can use either the query by example or the SQL view of your data to do the interface. Now there's some more about SQL statements, and I don't think I need to go over this detail again. You've already done select statements for querying particular things. I'm right, right? Yeah, okay. Here's some examples of select. I wanted to keep that in the Access part, though, so that it would be complete. Then update was when you changed information in a row. Delete, you can delete a row. Insert, you can add a row to the table. And then there are these data definition language things, create table, alter table, create index, drop the table from the database, or from the data table. Okay, so controls are how you structure the interface of all applications to Access. So controls can be things like forms, so that you can use them for inputting data. They can be things like reports, so that you can use them for outputting data, and for displaying other kinds of information. You can use them as global variables, so that you can calculate values from the table in between query statements and in a more, as you're writing application code that's taking, that's writing a more complex database operation than just one query or one access to the database. So controls have, it's object-oriented, so that controls, each instance of a control can have a set of values. You can think of that as being the instance variables of the class that the control is a member of. And so when you design them, you can have, like, an if you're creating a button, it's a control. It'll have a value, which is the label that you want to put on the button. So each there'll be information associated with that control. Here's an example for a text box. The value is the text inside the box, and so on. You can also have properties, which can be and similar includes both the idea of the instance variable, which you can update and put information in, as well as get information out of, and also, to a certain extent, it includes the notion of methods that a class would have there. You can have functions. So here's some more about forms and reports. The forms really are objects, and just point out one thing about forms is that you can also have forms which access data and reports data from a lot of different tables. This is not just a simple form where you like type in data to one table or something like that. These can be fairly complex. Then the form, each form and report is stored in a package. You can have event procedures that go with that to have actions happen when users create events such as clicking a button. Similar thing with reports. Now there are a lot of issues about multi-user applications that Access has that are very similar to the ones that Oracle has, and we talked about that. If you're having more than one user accessing database and trying to update information, then you have to worry about the integrity of the information so that you don't have more than one user trying to change it at the same time, or to have one user changing it while another user is trying to access it. So there, at the lower level, just like Oracle, this is handled by having locks placed on one or more records or rows of the table so that only one user can access at a time. There's also the notion of, I think I'm right, it doesn't actually say this here, the notion of transaction, right, so that you can do more than one operation at a time. Am I right? Is Access transaction based? No one knows. Okay, I'll put that question in my head. I'm going to check that out. But my impression is that with Oracle, all the concurrency issues are handled by the database implementation, and that with Access, when you're programming multi-user applications, you have to worry some in your own program about the multi-user issues. So here are the kinds of security models that you have, the work group-based security model, so that you can have various users in one work group and have levels of access defined for, or levels of permissions for the various users. There's a password security model. You can use both of those. And there's also encryption so that when you're passing information around a network that you don't have any problem with hackers getting a hold of your information, it reduces database performance by 10 to 15%. Okay. So we said that you could use, in the introduction, that you could use access through a programming interface. And this programming interface is a client-server type organization. And you can have a programming interface that just accesses the database as if it were a file server to retrieve data directly. You can have a client that links to, there is an ODBC driver for access, so that you can use that. Did we talk about what ODBC was? Oh yeah, because I couldn't remember what it was. I think it's Open Database Connection. So it's the C open standard, standard connection to SQL relational databases. And there's a direct connection using what's called data access objects, and so on. Whoops. Now, the other thing that's happened in Office 97 in general is that Microsoft is trying to put in into their all their applications a very web-aware type thing. So, for example, just like Oracle, you can store hyperlinks in your database, and you can also, in Access, get information out in various kinds of web-aware ways so that you can save to HTML, which will create an HTML version of the data that you're working with. You can create HTML pages that have links to databases, and we don't need to talk about internet replication. And then there's the web wizard for helping to publish database information to the web dynamically. So the web wizard will create static HTML pages. So it'll help you create them just out of the database information. Or you can have dynamic internet database connection pages. So there's a special format for HTML extensions that the wizard helps you generate web pages that have essentially web access. This is all, of course, proprietary. You have to have the Microsoft Information Server, Internet Information Server, the IIS 3.0 with an ODBC connection. So this will only be working on essentially Microsoft platforms. This is a proprietary kind of solution. And furthermore, you can interact with ActiveX layout control, so that you can interface with what we're going to talk about next time. So the files that are created are called Active Server Pages, which they have ActiveX controls, and we'll talk more about ActiveX next time. It's a combination of HTML and Visual Basic Script, similar way that when we did JavaScript, it was done with pages that was a combination of HTML and JavaScript. It uses the same script tag and everything. So we'll talk about that next time. It has the disadvantage that you can only use it on Internet Explorer browsers. And I don't know if Netscape has any plans to support that. I see this diagram didn't come through very well. But basically, the Microsoft IIS, the Internet Information Server, has what they call peer services of the various Internet services, web, FTP, and so on. It has interface layers that go through ODBC to the various drivers for the various things, like, I can't read these, but I assume it's Access, Excel, the various kinds of applications, Word, that you can use to connect to. Here's a couple of examples. Can you read that up there? I can't see that down there myself, but I have it here on the screen where it looks fine. And we're not going to go through this in detail. We just wanted you to see a little bit of what it looked like. And this is a sample code for one of these ASP files that can be from the wizard can be generated as database access, web database access. So this is just HTML, but in the HTML, is some code that looks like a comment to the browser, but is actually ODBC code that does the connection to the database. So it sets up a connection, does it to the server. Here's the end of this comment. So that's the end of that particular so setting up the connection. And here's some more code about doing a query. And so this is the script language for doing the ODBC connection. Then in addition, you might have Visual Basic Script. And we're going to talk about this quite a bit next time for little programs that can also, in general, access controls, including controls that could be specific for accessing the database. Okay, so now let's just say a couple of words about automation in general in the Microsoft system. Automation is the technology that allows two applications to talk to each other, and the way they have it structured is that there is one automation server that sort of sits in the middle of everything, and every application is a client to that server, so the applications are things like Access, Excel, Word, and so on. Oh, here's a list: PowerPoint, Visual Basic, any application in Visual Basic. So the it's all object oriented. So when the client wants to connect to the server, it creates an object. It's a conversation with the server. It tells it which other objects it either wants to acquire from some other application or export to some other application. Here are some of the examples of the classes that come with particular kinds of applications. I'm not going to go through that in detail. Here's a diagram of the automation server and an application that uses various a user application that uses various of these kinds of applications. So here's an example of a type of thing, a mail merge tool that can insert data from any of these other applications into a Word document. And as you know, that's the kind of thing that you can do in Word now. A tool that creates a PowerPoint presentation that can import data from the database. A tool that can use Excel to summarize data from the database. Those are the kinds of applications that you might want to write. Okay, so that kind of finishes up that little subsection on Access and what some of its capabilities are. We wanted to show a different kind of a database. It has many similarities to Oracle, some differences, and we are going to have at some point JDBC started to say Access to Access, but connected, JDBC connected to Access. And we have it running now, but we don't on a local PC. We're trying to get it done on the network PCs in the lab. So now we're going to go back to talking about JDBC architecture. So we already talked about the JDBC API, So that are the Java classes that you use in your Java program, whether it's an applet or an application, where you make the connection, you can create statements, you can query. It's a standard interface to whatever database you might want. In addition, there is a JDBC driver API for which drivers have to implement in order to provide those services. So these are the driver types that are defined by Java, by Sun, and there are four of them, and this particular slide doesn't number them, but the first one is number one, which is the JDBC-ODBC bridge, and that provides JDBC access through most ODBC drivers. So for the most part, when the bridge is provided, in fact, I think all the ones, is that true? Well, let me not say all. Most of the ones that we have are install the JDBC connection by having ODBC native code in the classes. So this limits this driver to the kinds of limitations where you're on the same machine or you're on a corporate intranet, not outside network access for arbitrary people over the web. Actually, in this class, we're all used to using the web as more for, you know, kind of a being able to access information from anywhere on any kind of client machine, right? But a lot of the uses of web technology and web programs are going to be used for corporate intranets. And there, this is where the corporate intranet technology might be a little different from the standard, you know, open web technology. Anybody can access it. I mean, for one thing, they're not going to want everybody in the world to access their corporate databases. And for another thing, the general solution for internet access might not have good enough performance. So there's been allowance made in the JDBC, the types of drivers that you can have, so that you can have different kinds, some of which are proprietary solutions and limited to the network access, but that's going to be fine inside a corporation that's like one building or something. It might not be fine for the kind of corporation like Carrier, which is a worldwide and has parts of its database in Hong Kong and part, you know, in various places. So anyway, the first two types, this is number one and number two on this slide, are aimed at not necessarily general World Wide Web access. You can think of these as being the kinds of things where you have to have the client on the same machine or on a known network, controlled network, not an intranet instead of an internet. So the first one is the JDBC-ODBC bridge. I'm getting better at pronouncing that without stumbling over all the D's and B's. The second one is called the Native API Partly Java Driver. And it, and this is the one where you have you have classes for JDBC where the classes implement the JDBC methods directly into calls for whatever database it's trying to get access to. So this is like the two-tier kind of architecture. The next one listed here, Net Protocol All Java Driver, is actually called Type 3. And this is, in fact, the general solution for arbitrary, that can be used for general solutions for arbitrary internet access. It assumes that the JDBC calls are going to be translated into some possibly database-oriented but independent network kind of protocol, which then can be used to go to a middle server and be translated into proprietary information for possibly many different databases. So that's the servlet solution we saw. The servlet solution is, in fact, uses for the so-called independent net protocol the HTTP network protocol. But that's not necessary. It could be that there is some other network protocol. I jotted down, I can never remember all these acronyms. One of them that's just come out that was having a, I was reading about, there's a new protocol called Internet InterORB, IIOP, and some companies, including one called Visigenic, are writing drivers that can be used anywhere on the Internet, but they convert the JDBC call into this particular network protocol, but it's a network protocol that's open and can be done on a general network type solution that goes back to the middleware. Okay? So this is like the three-tier solution that we saw. Now the next one, the last one, native protocol, all Java driver, is number four in the JDB, in the Java list. And this converts JDBC calls into possibly, well, into a network protocol that's used directly by the database server. So this is not necessarily a general network solution. I mean, it would use something like SQLNet from Oracle to actually do the network protocol, which could go directly to an Oracle server. So this would be a solution that could be a very wide network solution, but would be higher performance and might be a practical solution for companies that wanted to have access over over a wider area. Here's some more. I believe this pretty much just gives another summary of what the JDBC classes are that a driver has to implement. So I'm not going to go to that in detail. It doesn't talk too much about what they have to do it, but just think about it from the driver side. You have to be able to implement callable statement, the effect of a stored procedure. Of course, you have to implement a connection between the client and the database server, and so on. You have to be able to return metadata, be able to create a driver, execute SQL prepared statements, return a result set. So these are, I won't go over this in detail because we looked at the code that used all these things in a JDBC example. Result metadata statements. I've already talked about some of these issues about writing drivers when I was talking about the different types of drivers, but let me just go through these again because I don't remember if I said all the detail that I should have. So suppose that you have a native protocol all Java driver, and that, of course, is a type 4, and this is what the... We did see an example in that first lecture of an MSQL JDBC driver, and it's of this type. It can be used from anywhere on the network, but the driver implements the JDBC calls directly into particular database support. I don't think this is giving more details about this type of driver. Notice that when you give the URL for this type of a driver, it's going to specify a host and a port, and an address of where to connect to the driver for the database. This is the WebLogic driver that we saw in the two-tier application. Is an example of how you connect to it, of what you have to give. And this particular one has the limitation that you have to be on the same machine. And then there's a discussion of what's called the remote JDBC driver. And this is the number three type of driver, and which is sort of the general solution. This is the one that we saw the servlet solution to. So you have to think about the driver being implemented in two different parts. There's the client-side part, which is implements the JDBC API, and there's the service-side part, which in the example we looked at was the servlet that was written to run on the web server that was going to make the actual database connection. And finally here we come to a diagram. Again, these texts didn't convert very well. That shows the three-tier architecture where you have Java programs using JDBC. The client uses some general net protocol to connect to the middleware server for the JDBC, and it connects to the database server, which is the JDBC driver directly. I think I've kind of said most of this stuff. Well, maybe I haven't. Maybe this is not as obvious as I think. So in this case, of course, I've already said this stuff, right? The JDBC is translated to some network protocol. Of course, there is communication. Both you have to establish it from the client to pass the queries and the server to pass back the data. The server side, the middleware, can either be a Java server with a socket implementation, or it can be listed at a specified URL, such as the servlet on a Java web server, which is the one that we saw. So the advantage, of course, is that you can do this. This is the arbitrary net access. You can do it for, you don't have to download proprietary code or native code to run on all the different kinds of clients. You have a general solution for the browser clients. And all you have to do is have specific code in the middleware, which can run on a much smaller class of machines. It doesn't have to be implemented for so many different machines as the web browser might. So the feeling is that these kinds of solutions, though, won't have as much potential for high-performance access to the database, that they will necessarily be limited by sort of the general net connection and can't be optimized as much. Okay, the last section I have here is just talking about using JDBC, an example that has been programmed here with more than one kind of database. So this particular example, unfortunately I can't show you, but it's done by a small company called Syracuse Language Systems, and it's called Language Connect University, and they do distance learning right now with various languages, but they've just developed a module with MPAC sort of doing the back-end database work for doing for teaching Spanish over the internet. so that you can take a course with them where you do all your coursework on your web browser. And it includes, so there's each class, they, you know, might be telling you some grammar. I've seen a demonstration of this, or some other kinds of vocabulary. Then you have quizzes and so on, including recorded audio. So you may have to, as part of your work, record Spanish, and that's sent in to your instructor over the web and stored in the database of all your work, and the instructor can come along and listen to how you recorded that particular sentence and can correct your pronunciation, give you a better example, and send it back to you, and so on. So it's kind of a nifty system, but it does make extensive use of databases. The class, most of the class data, the already prepared text and book exercises and so on is stored in the Oracle database, and information about the various students, though, is, I believe, stored in the Access database. And the reason for that was that they wanted to use the Access forms to automatically edit and update the students' records as they progress throughout their work. And I'm not sure the reason for that, but that's what they wanted to do. So it was required to develop on the web programming the JDBC that could work both with Access and with Oracle. So they did use the now called the Java Web Server, formerly called Jeeves, to write applets. And so they have it, we showed it working with Osprey 7. They have it working for Oracle. They also have it working for Access. So when the student wants to access information, then the JDBC connects Osprey 7 and downloads whatever quizzes, tests, whatever the student wants to do. It shows up on their web page. Then they will, student will ask, answer some questions and so on. This will go back to the Jeeves server, but this time the servlet will access the access database to record the student's work using the JDBC ODBC driver on Windows to transfer the student's data to the Access database. So now there's a whole set of web forms that the student's work is plugged into and can be sent back to the student, so the student can check on the collection of their work. And also the instructors will use these forms through the Access database to make the remarks, to correct the pronunciation and so on. And that's all sent back to the student from the Access database. So this is a real-world example using JDBC to connect to more than one type of database. And I don't have, I don't know if I can show it to you at any point, but right now I don't know how to show it to you. So I won't be showing that to you tonight. So on Wednesday night, we're going to be doing talking about ActiveX and then on, and that'll be me, and then on Monday night is your last class, and Professor Fox will be back and we'll finish the VRML 2.0 lecture showing you how to do motion in the 2.0 VRML scene. And do you have any questions about what you're doing for homework or projects? Or the people that wanted to use VRML 2.0 on the PC lab, I'm not sure if they have Cosmo Player installed there yet, so I haven't solved that problem yet. Were there any other issues? Only one person emailed me that they wanted to do that. So if you want to do that, you have to email me right away. because you actually have to have an account installed down there. Any other questions? Software? Right kind of projects? Okay, so be it. Oh, yeah, that sounds like it.